I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Orange County property appraiser Rick Singh is hosting a state of real estate summit this week. He plans to release property value data that's normally kept quiet and shared only with leaders in county and city government. Singh says he hopes the move will add some transparency to the office of appraiser.
Who is the property appraiser and what does the property appraiser do? That should not be a question that should be asked by the average citizen.
A conversation with Orange County property appraiser Rick Singh. But first, Republicans are still reeling from the primary election loss of House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. The loss forced Cantor to step down from his leadership role in the House and has many questioning the Republican leadership and the strategy of Democrats in upcoming midterm elections. To talk more about the primary decision in Virginia and other political stories impacting Florida, I'll speak with 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by 90.7 political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. Dick Batchelor, a former Democratic State House representative, is also the founder and president of the Dick Batchelor Management Group. Dick, nice to have you back again.
Thank you for having us.
And of course, Lou Fry, a former Republican congressman. He's the founder of the Lou Fry Institute for Politics and Government at the University of Central Florida. Lou, nice to see you too.
Day in politics is a lifetime. Bachelor and Fry.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Bachelor and Fry back together again. Okay, so first of all, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor losing the Republican primary in his district in Virginia, a bit of a shock for him and for others there, to political newcomer and Tea Party-backed Dave Bratt. Lou, I want to start with you now. What does this mean for the Republican congressional leadership?
Well, if they don't get it under control quickly, it means the Democrats are going to run the House. This is one of those elections that just comes out of nowhere, very easily explainable. Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't take care of the home, folks, you're in trouble. I don't care who you are. We've seen it over again, over and over in the years. But the person that gets banged on it never figures it out till the election's over. And the problem is more internal than it is external. The external part of winning a race or losing it, you got a year to go, basically. Not a year to go anymore, but you got some time to go anyway. And so it is going to make a difference. But if that thing becomes viral, and people now say, oh, hey, look, we could knock off the Republicans. We can do this. You're going to have the Democrats all of a sudden getting pretty bolstered about what's going on, Dick. I think they're pretty excited about the thing, picking off some districts that they weren't going to go for. And the Republicans have bought themselves a real bag of worms on this thing. And, you know, thank goodness it wasn't 2 months before the election this fall.
Dick Batchelor, Democrats rather rubbing their hands with glee over this?
Well, I think so. Well, kind of an approach avoidance conflict. On one hand, it's attractive because Eric Cantor got beat, the majority leader, which is unheard of and really a shock to everyone. The other side of that coin, though, is that does it push the Republicans even further to the right? Can you do immigration reform? Are you going to be threatened with not voting for the debt limit and also shutting down government? What is going to happen? But Lou makes a very good point, which I hadn't thought about, and that is, you know, midterm elections, we fully expect that the Republicans will retain control of the House. But is this going to force them so far to the right that some Democrats have a leeway to try to win? And particularly in the Senate race now, what happens here with Senator Cochran in Mississippi? You know, he's in a runoff with the Tea Party there. This is kind of embolden the Tea Party and say, we're going to take him out too, and then you got two you've taken out. So it's going to be a very interesting ramifications that are far beyond Eric Cantor's seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was a good legislator.
He really did
a good job, and he was the speaker relied on him a great deal to get those extra few votes during the major legislative battles we've had. And, you know, they're not going to shut down the government over this one seat. I can guarantee you that. You can take that to bed. But on the other hand, you can take this and you can blow it up into certain areas where there were marginal seats. And that's what they're doing right now in Washington. They're looking and seeing which seats are really marginal and what can the Republicans do. And is the best they can do is pick up their cards and go on and find somebody good to, you know, hope the guy, I don't know who he is. I've never met him before.
If this tide continues, though, let's say that Cochran is beaten in Mississippi, Tea Party hoist another flag on the hill. What happens in 2016? Does it move Ted Cruz to the front of the line? And then what does it do?
He can't move any further than where he is.
But Jeb Bush, though, you know, here Jeb Bush, immigration is one of his issues. But immigration was a big issue in this race, too. But if you beat Thad Cochran in Mississippi, Tea Party, again, hoist another flag, do send signals out to 2016. Well, bring on Ted Cruz and Jeb Bush. Maybe you get pushed back on this one. So it's the ramifications, again, are far beyond 2014.
Yeah, and Florida, of course, being the key state in it, is very much in the midst of it, and we'll see how hard people are going to play it. We'll see how good the Republicans are of getting this thing in the garbage can and moving on.
Are Democrats going to be thinking about putting money into some of these other races where Tea Party candidates are looking to take on Republicans, rather?
Well, keep in mind, so far this year, the Republican establishment, if I can call them that, have done very well by beating back the Tea Party and the Chamber of, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, and others have been very supportive of the what I would call the moderate Republicans, and they've won every race except this race. But it happens to be majority leader, so it's resounding.
Let's switch gears a little bit. There was a shakeup in the VA after it was revealed that VA staff falsified wait time records for veterans seeking medical care, and of course Eric Shinseki resigning. What do you guys see Congress doing now to try and fix these issues, and what about right here in Central Florida?
Yeah, let me just jump in because I look at this thing, and Dick knows. I introduced the legislation to get that VA hospital in 1969, not 79 or 89, 1969. 69. Put it in Brevard County originally because of the 20,000 jobs lost from the Apollo to the shuttle and terrible unemployment in the Brevard County area, which spilled over to here. So that went from there, and then later on, because things evened out and we had a congressman from here, a Democrat, went from Brevard County back to Orange County. It was like a bouncing ball, but it kept going. But like with the VA, it was really, really unsettling to deal with them because nothing would ever get done. There'd always be a reason. They'd outweigh you. You know, they'd actually outweigh you till you, if you didn't lose, then you was never in trouble, but they'd outweigh you with the staff people. And when you look at it, of all the people you can pick out, probably this is the group that you really don't want to just ignore. You know, they've done so much in so many ways. We're doing a golf tournament with the Wounded Warriors. And, I mean, these people are just wonderful, but they're hurting. Mm-hmm. And they deserve the best care, not the worst care. And Dick was, you know, he saw most of it in Vietnam.
And they're not getting the right kind of care. What it, I think it proves a couple of things. One is obviously there's a horrible mismanagement at the Veterans Administration. Two, they're probably overbooked and overloaded because you've got so many veterans returning from Afghanistan and Iraq and the need to help they never needed before. But the change in leadership will make some changes. But I think what it really shows is that Congress can come together. You know, there's a bill that's going to be passed, and I would hope in the next few days, that's going to basically allow veterans who can't get in line to get health care to go to the private sector to get health care. They're going to put $35 billion in the budget for that. So it shows that when there's an urgency like this, the Congress can react. But as Lou said, that the problems with the Veterans Administration have been going on for a long time. But fortunately, they are responding in kind.
And from the top to the bottom, they got to basically clean out and start over.
Oh, yeah. One of the pieces of the legislation that they're looking to pass exempts about 435 people from what we'll call career exempt status, which means you can fire them. You can't fire anybody now but for mismanagement. But now this legislation was able, the new secretary, whoever that might be, to have power to fire people for mismanagement.
Who would want that job?
I think somebody who really want to advocate for the veterans is a tough job. There is a lot of problems. They're working on computer systems that are decades old. They're really not up to par where they should be, and that's, frankly, the neglect by the Congress over the past many years. But I think somebody who wants to be an advocate for the veteran, at least they've got support of the Congress now. They've got the eyes of the country on them. They've got new money in the budget, so I think it's a lot better than it would be under the previous leadership.
Yeah, and people are picking it up all over. We're doing a charity golf tournament, but there's places reserved for the Wounded Warriors, and I was in one up in Washington, and the people are really not just talking about it, but they're actually moving, and money's moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of good people in this country. I mean, they really are, and it happens sometimes that you get in a mess you can't get out of necessarily. You got to get somebody else to come on in. But I think the message is clear, is that, you know, and we had D-Day, and we actually celebrated D-Day. I am just so pleased that people recognize that D-Day, you know, was June 6th and that. And so there are signs that things are moving in the right direction, and that we've got a way to go, but I think we're in the right path, yeah. Dick.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about something else military-related, the Bo Bergdahl exchange. Obviously, President Obama copping quite a lot of criticism for that over the way that was done, and how Congress wasn't kind of kept they weren't kept informed about what was going on before it happened. Dick Batchelor, what do you think about the way this exchange was done? Was this done in the right way?
Well, there are a lot of questions attendant to it. Number one, we do prisoner exchange. We did that for a helicopter pilot who went down in Somalia. There was arms for hostages during the Reagan administration. Excuse me. So it's not unprecedented. But what we learned afterwards is what's troubling the people. Number one, did you trade him for, you know, five hostages that were really bad dudes, for lack of a better expression, number one? Number two, did you exercise the Second Amendment to this Article 2 of the Constitution appropriately, or did you bypass the Congress when there's legislation saying you got to brief Congress within 30 days? So it brings a lot of questions to light. And then the discussion now, which really at the rumor side, is whether or not he really vacated his post. Was he AWOL? Was he not? You know, on one hand, if he was a Medal of Honor winner, we would all be singing everyone's praises. But there's so many pieces that have come out. It's a very difficult issue for the president. And the veterans were recently polled and overwhelmingly were opposed to the decision for mm-hmm. the exchange. So a lot of pieces of this puzzle.
And there's been some criticism from other service members who were involved in searching for this.
Right, saying that there were six people who died while right. searching for him. And again, that hasn't been proven. What might happen here in this situation is not that we're uncovering a lot of stuff about him. You know, he might come back to the United States and go on trial. Mm-hmm. He might be court-martialed.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're speaking to political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fry. You can join the conversation online. Send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. You can also send us a tweet and join the conversation on Facebook, too. I want to move to a little more local politics here. Recently, Orlando Police Chief and candidate for Orange County, former Orlando Police Chief rather, and candidate for Orange County Mayor Val Demings dropped out of the race against Mayor Teresa Jacobs. She hasn't said a lot about it since. Dick Batchelor, what are your thoughts on this? I mean, was this race at all ever winnable for her?
I think Lou and I both said it was going to be extremely difficult. You've got an incumbent mayor who polls very strongly. She's very, very popular. She's raised $700,000, which means she could make probably raise a total of $1 million. Val, who's an incredibly attractive candidate, got in the race, raised about $250,000, which was admirable, but nowhere to compare to $1 million in the race, and obviously got out of the race. I would hope that she would find another post in which to serve. She has been a terrific public servant, and she will be. But I think she finally read the tea leaves and the polls and said, this is just not one you could do. And
she didn't lose it. That's really important when you look at her future. She did not lose it. So if somebody comes along, maybe a vice president nomination and mm-hmm. that, she's still viable. But as Dick and I were saying, the thing, you got to look at your money. Both of us endorsed the mayor early,
right,
before when it was not a race at all. And she's done a good job. She's putting it together. She has the money. She hasn't made any mistakes. And it was, there's time you got to know when you put up that white flag and just get out of Dodge and without losing.
What would your advice be to Val Demings, Lou Fry?
My advice to her would be work hard, don't say too much, build a nice campaign base, look for things to do besides the political side of it, to work maybe on institutes for kids or college kids or something like that. Just charge on with the thing. This isn't the year. This still remembers an off-year election for a Democrat president. This usually doesn't really do very well, and I think it's probably going to somewhat end up like that. Despite what the Republicans, the circular firing squad they have that Dick loves to talk about, despite that circular firing squad, I think they're going to be able to eke out the House.
Mm-hmm. I think two things. If I were Charlie Crist, I would have a short list of possible running mates as lieutenant governor. She would be on that short list. She's a very attractive former police chief, as you mentioned. Was a very strong candidate for the U.S. Congress. She's in the I-4 corridor for all the reasons I don't have on my short list. And secondly, though, there's a court contest as to whether or not Congresswoman Corinne Brown's district is going to be changed, accused of being gerrymandered. If the court rules that the district has to be redrawn, part of that district is going to go to Dan Webster's district, which is going to make Dan Webster's district a Democratic-leaning district, which invites an opportunity for Val to come back and run for Congress if she wants to next year.
Mm-hmm. Maybe too quick, but it certainly would be a good opening. And again, the Republicans, remember, are up in Congress. They're going to have to be voting on some of these issues. You know, what are they going to do about the environment? What are they going to do about the people coming across the border, you know?
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, I mean, would she think twice about taking on Dan Webster again?
Not if the district's redrawn, and not if the district becomes Democratic-leaning, because mm-hmm. she was extremely close last time, and she spent a considerable amount of money, but she was very, very close. But if that district gets, you know, if it gets redrawn, Corinne Brown's district, which is primarily African-American, gets shifted into Webster district, it makes it a tip to the Democrat, then she would have a very good shot at it. And I think that's where her passion really is.
I've been speaking to 90.7's political commentators Dick Batchelor and Lou Fryer. Dick Batchelor, nice as always to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
And Lou Fryer, good to see you again too.
Not gone already, the time?
Yes, time flies when you're talking politics.
I know. Yeah.
And sometimes it goes too fast.
Indeed, indeed. Up next, a conversation with Orange County property appraiser Rick Singh. Orange County property appraiser Rick Singh is hosting the State of Real Estate this week at Full Sail University. He joined me in the studio to preview the forum. First of all, I want to ask you just a few questions about the Real Estate Forum. What exactly is it, and I guess why are you deciding to have it now and here in Orange County?
Yeah, so the State of Real Estate is the very first time any property appraiser in the state of Florida is having this event. Traditionally, this is the time of year when property appraisers all across the state will send their best estimates to the Department of Revenue. Traditionally, this is always a number that's kept on the hush-hush. You know, it's put in envelopes and given to mayors privately. But I feel firmly that this is the public's number. I feel that this is a number that belongs to the public, and I'm confident of this number enough to have a discussion on it. So that's essentially what we're doing at the State of Real Estate on the 18th of this month, which is coming up very shortly. And, you know, we're hoping to, you know, have a dialogue about the number. We're putting together, I will, of course, present the numbers and delve into the areas that of growth and areas that didn't do so well and have a discussion on it. But above and beyond that, we're going a little further and having industry experts talk about these numbers. So we've got a wonderful panel, Chuck Waddell from Unicorp. We've got a representative of the Orlando Board of Realtor. We've got a Gary Manfredi, who is one of our top economists in the area. Wayne Rich, a real estate expert in the area of law. Dana Kilborn, who represent the banking industry. She's, of course, the CEO of Florida Bank of Commerce. And then we have Mark Wiley, who's the president and CEO of the Association of Builders and Contractors. And, of course, I'll be representing the appraisal industry. So we've got a good cross-section of the real estate industry represented, and we'll just talk about the growth that we're experiencing here in Central Florida.
Who's invited?
The public is invited. It's held at Full Sail Live in Winter Park. And, of course, we're inviting everyone to come. It's at Full Sail University. And the doors are opening at 5:30 sharply, so we're asking you to please come on time. And we're hoping to have a discussion on real estate.
So typically it's an estimate of what you think values are going to be for the following 12 months? Is that how it
works? Yes. So we're estimating what the tax roll will finally derive at after adjustments are made. And, you know, we're experiencing some tremendous growth. You know, the public don't know the enormousness of this tax roll we've got in Central Florida. A little tidbit and a preview to the presentation is the fact that the commercial property in Orlando, in Orange County, is more than the total tax roll of 53 of the 67 counties in the state of Florida, just the commercial portion of the tax roll. So this tax roll in Orange County is an enormous tax roll, a very diverse and unique tax roll, and we'll talk about those intricacies.
When people think about property, I think most of the time they think about residential property, but you're saying that, actually commercial property is where we're seeing growth here in Orange County?
Yeah, so we are seeing a cross-section of growth all across the table. As an example, last year we've had $1.5 billion of construction. When you think about it, that's $4.4 million a day that we're seeing. We are leading growth in the state of Florida. That's a very positive thing. We should be talking about it here in the state, in Orange County.
That's not unusual, though, for Orlando, is it? There's always construction going on. I know that the city, for example, seems to be going through a bit of a boom at the moment, and the mayor himself has made jokes about it being the city of cranes, because when you drive past City Hall, you see those cranes over the Dr. Phillips Performing Arts Center, for example. But it seems like Orlando is always building and expanding.
Yeah, Orlando is always building and expanding, but if you just our recent history, we didn't have cranes just about 3-4 years ago. So, you know, I joked with my counterpart in Hillsborough County. I was in Tampa for a discussion of property appraisers, and you know, Tampa didn't have cranes. Look at their numbers; it's representative of a very stagnated growth. So Tampa's numbers are behind us. Cranes are always, and of course the mayor is always right to indicate that crane is always an indicator of growth. You know, $1.5 billion is nothing to sneeze at. It's a tremendous amount of construction. And that's just the representative of the construction portion of the growth. We have additional growth just from the inertia of the economy.
In Orlando itself, too, median property prices, residential, have gone up by about 12%, I think.
Taxable value has gone up. It's gone up right around 10-11%. Different areas have gone up more than that, and some areas have gone down less than that. The real pure number is the taxable value, and that is, of course, the total market value, taking away your exemptions, and that's the taxable value. And that's more in the area of 6 or 7%.
Mm-hmm. That 12%, though, for somebody who's looking to buy a house, I mean, is that a concern for you as a property appraiser? Do you see that as indications of maybe another bubble coming through, or is it just good to have that kind of growth?
Well, I see it as growth. I don't know if it's going to be a bubble, but you know, bubbles are very cyclical. Those of us that have studied growth, you know, as for a profession, it's a very cyclical thing. Looking at growth and looking at recessions, it's always a certain amount of years, and they come back. I think it's more of a healthy growth. I think it's more of a stable growth. I think we see a lot of more prudent buyers in the market, by way of REITs, by way of you know, even the average individual buyer that's buying out there, he's more of a qualified buyer, he's more of an intelligent buyer. So I think that adds to the climate of the real estate growth.
There are some pressure points, too, around Orlando. Like, for example, East Orlando, there are plans for more development out there. I know some of the residents are concerned about the green space being eaten up, and just recently this week we reported on some concerns from residents down in the Narcoosie area about a new road extension going through there and that having some impact on them. So what kind of pressure points are you seeing, and what can you do as a property appraiser to help alleviate that or kind of channel some of that?
Well, you know, as the property appraiser, I don't feel we have a lot of say on policy. That's more of a policy issue. But what I will say, as a resident of Orange County, you know, I came to Orange County back in 1986 when that very Lake Nona area was a dirt road to be connected to St. Cloud. It was, you know, Narcoosie Road, very popularly known as Narcoosie Road, was a dirt road. Now you go through, it's one of the fastest growing area in the state, if not the country, Lake Nona. So, you know, that's a good problem to have. To have our citizens dialogue about growth and the repercussions and effects of growth is always good for the economy.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the presentation, you're going to be talking about some of the areas of growth and some of the areas where you haven't seen the kind of growth you would expect. Can you share any?
So we'll be talking about the growth. We'll be talking about, you know, we've got the 13 municipalities around town, around Orange County, and we'll be talking a little bit about all of them, We'll be talking about the areas that we can see, you know, a little bit of growth. We'll be talking about the areas that we've seen a tremendous amount of growth. So we'll be talking about all of the growth in Orange County with, you know, specifically, you know, Winter Garden, I think, is one area that's seeing a lot of growth. Lake Nona has seen a tremendous amount of growth. So we'll delve down into those areas. And then there are little towns like Oakland. There's towns like Eatonville that hasn't seen the numbers that Winter Garden or Lake Nona has seen, but they are growing. We've actually worked, I have worked with the mayor of Eatonville to show him how to, you know, use the resources that he has to experience some growth.
There are some interesting things happening in Eatonville, though, aren't there? Like design ideas, they've got maybe some new transportation could help them out. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I think Eatonville is one of those towns that if you put a exit, you know, right there at Eatonville, I think it would explode.
You're talking about off the I-4?
Off the I-4, yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's always a want and desire of the leadership of Eatonville. I was at a forum with Congresswoman Corinne Brown and the Secretary of Transportation, and that was brought up, you know. So, yeah, they are somewhat landlocked. But I don't think that's a major concern. I think it's a concern that we've seen is the commercial growth in Eatonville. You know, I think that needs to be stimulated. I think once that's stimulated, Eatonville will come back nicely.
Do you think other property appraisers are going to follow your lead and start holding these seminars rather than, as before, releasing these data kind of on the quiet?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. You know, I firmly believe that the property appraiser's office is the people's office. I think property appraisers ought to realize this, recognize this and realize this and act on it. You know, my mandate is to bring this office back to the people, put it in the hands of the people, have the people respond positively or negatively to the property appraiser and really engage the public. You know, one of the challenges when I ran for this office was people ask me, who is the property appraiser and what does the property appraiser do? That should not be a question that should be asked by the average citizen. It's really a deficiency, I think, of the office. If the office don't engage the public and let the public know what they do, I think it's our mandate as elected officials and as leaders of Orange County to let the public know what we do.
And just finally, I mean, you talk about the tax base and the fact that, you know, we have this tax base here in Orange County. It's kind of important in Florida, isn't it, because there's no income tax. So I guess growth is good from that point of view and sort of generating revenue and giving local government more to work with.
Absolutely, absolutely. Growth is so, so important. You know, that's one of the reasons why we have essentially, you know, put a compliance team into effect at the property appraiser's office. We're cracking down on homestead exemption fraud to the tune of $68.5 million, you know, just for the year of 13 that I've put back on the tax roll by really coordinating resources, putting the right people in the right jobs and giving them a mandate and giving them a vision, giving them leadership. They were able to do this in the span of, you know, 2013, $68.5 million. That's money you and I, the average taxpayers, don't have to come up with. And again, it's catching tax cheat doing the wrong thing. So that's something we've been focusing on at this office, and we hope to continue to focus on it. So again, if someone is getting away with homestead exemption fraud, we encourage the public to call our hotline at the office. The numbers can be reached from our website and report homestead exemption fraud. I firmly believe if we all pay our fair share, we all pay less.
I've been speaking to Rick Singh, the property appraiser for Orange County. We've been talking about the State of Real Estate Forum happening this week. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.